she was gonna keep. Oh yeah, alright, take it easy baby, make it last all night. She was an American girl.
This is Deborah Craddock, a podcast where we sit down with everyday Americans and hear their extraordinary stories. I'm your host, Deborah Drucker. Come along with me as we discuss those things that we were always told not to talk about. Politics, religion, and more. I promise you'll be inspired and have your mind opened by the end of this episode.
Well, it was kind of cold that night. She stood alone on the balcony. Yeah, she could hear the cars roll by out on 441, like waves crashing on the beach.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Deborah Craddock. Today on Deborah Craddock, we will be getting up close and personal with Jeffrey Lichtman. Jeffrey is a renowned criminal defense attorney who has represented mobster John A. Gotti and the Mexican drug lord El Chapo, amongst others. He is an avid collector specializing in rare baseball cards. Jeffrey is a big supporter of Israel. He is also the host of his own podcast, Beyond the Legal Limit. Let's hear what this American powerhouse has to say. Hello, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having me, Deb.
So happy you joined us today. I know how busy you are. And I'm going to start from the beginning. We know you are a New Yorker now, but where are you originally from?
Well, I grew up in the suburbs of New Jersey, Union County, about half an hour away from New York City. But when you're from New Jersey, from the suburbs, it might as well have been 2,000 miles away. Going into the city was like a big deal. Maybe it was twice a year. I was basically from Iowa with a lot more Italians, I suppose.
And who did you grow up with there in New Jersey?
Well, I had my parents were together for part of my childhood. I have an older brother and a younger sister. I begged for a dog my entire childhood. And this is a big deal. And I learned this as a parent, that when your kid asks for a dog, you give them a dog. And my parents would never give me a dog. And now, of course, I'm a crazed animal lover and have two dogs and a stolen cat.
And why? What was their reasoning? Why didn't they want you to have a dog?
You know, I think it was just a different generation back in the 70s. My mother basically was concerned about the hair in the house. So you deny a kid the love of his life, a dog, because you didn't want to have to do some extra vacuuming once or twice a week. That was basically the rationale, as far as I can tell.
And was that a happy home life?
I don't think it was a particularly happy home life. My parents got divorced when I was, I guess, about 14 or so. They were constantly trying to kill each other, from my memory, growing up. So it was a stressful childhood. And I think that in a lot of ways it helped me as a defense lawyer, because I find that in the most stressful of circumstances, I'm very calm. When everything is calm, I'm very uptight. So I find that it has helped me to some extent. And I think that's true with anything in life, is that, you know, whatever the hand that you're dealt, you just use it to make it into a positive if you can.
While your dad was in the house and it was the five of you, was it a political household? Was there any political affiliation or perspective on politics?
You know, it was different. Back in the 70s, there wasn't this polarized nation that exists now. So if you're a Republican or a Democrat, there wasn't that much of a difference between the two. I don't remember politics being strong. I do remember my parents were strong supporters of Israel.
So I know that your father was a meatpacker. Does that make him a union man?
Well, he was the owner of a meatpacking company, so he probably loathed the unions, I would guess. I suppose, though, he probably was not, because he was the owner.
So therefore, he was probably more right-leaning politically.
I think back then, they were sort of in the middle. There was no real strong politics, maybe Republican, because my father was sort of a I would say, a beginning businessman. I remember when Nixon was about to be impeached, I suppose, and then resigned instead. There were no tears shed in my household for that. I was a Democrat growing up. I still consider myself in a lot of ways. I'm a social liberal pretty much on every issue, just about. So I consider myself, I suppose, a Republican at this point, but a very begrudging Republican, because there's so much of it that like literally makes me puke. At the same time, there's probably more of the Democratic Party that makes me puke, which is why I'm barely a Republican, if you can call it that.
Do you feel that politics at all played any role in the career you chose?
I really view people as they come to me. Not really as their affiliation, unless they're, you know, part of a political party or entity that wants to kill me. Then, of course, I might feel a little bit different. But I think that my identity as a Jew, as a Zionist, absolutely played into what I am as a lawyer today. I've always felt anti-Semitism from growing up. You know, nothing horrific like what exists today, I suppose, in America. But if you're a Jew growing up in America, you feel it. And sometimes you don't even recognize that you feel it because it becomes so second nature. You're always sort of guarding, waiting for it. And I remember when I went to Israel, all of a sudden you realize that you do feel a lot more anti-Semitism at home, because when you're in Israel, you see all the Israeli flags and it's just, you feel accepted for the first time in your life. And you realize that you, when you're home, my God, I do feel the anti-Semitism and I don't even notice it. You have to go to Israel before you appreciate that.
From my perspective, I've never seen such overt anti-Semitism, racism, homophobia, as I have. And I have to say, to me, the pinnacle of it was during the Trump days. And it's like he gave stage and light to neo-Nazis, you know, these protest marchers saying Jews will not replace us in Charlottesville, and the guys that were storming the Capitol on Jan 6 carrying swastikas and KKK flags. It was horrifying.
I hear what you're saying. And if this is what's so tough being a Jew, is that there's no safe haven. I loathe Trump and I would never vote for him. But after 9/11, I started seeing a shift in the Democratic Party becoming more anti-Semitic, more anti-Israel. And I begrudgingly became a Republican because, in my mind, the Republicans were more supportive of Israel. Any poll that you look at will show that more Republicans are supportive of Israel and Jews than Democrats. But it doesn't mean that there's not hatred in the Republican Party as well. So I am a Republican, but as I said, barely. I'm in that party with my eyes wide open, knowing that so many of them hate my guts. But the simple polls show half the Democratic Party supports Hamas. Maybe 5 or 10% of the Republican Party does. And to me, you know, that's all you have to look at.
Well, let's go back to you. I want to talk about you. I read somewhere that your dad said, and this is when you're a young man and you decide, I guess, that you want to pursue law, that your dad said Jeffrey was not shifty enough to be a lawyer.
Well, that happened. I was pre-med from birth, you know, Jewish kid from New Jersey. I had no choice. I was pre-med from the womb until I guess I was now finishing my sophomore year of college. And I was a very straightforward, very polite, very shy kid. That's just what I was. I was very type B. I was a very good pre-med student, which was part of the problem, is that I was pretty much an A student. And if you succeed in something, you sometimes feel, well, this is obviously for me because I'm good at it. But I had no interest in being a doctor. And it didn't really hit me until I was in college. I had a feeling. I had watched the Paul Newman movie, The Verdict, and I realized that was for me. I needed to be on a stage. I needed to be in front of people. I needed to be representing an underdog and changing minds. And I always felt it in me, and the pre-med stuff never really resonated. So one day while I was in a biology lab, we were cutting apart, I think it was a pig, and the professors came over and said, oh, look at Jeff's Malpighian tubules. You can see them. And I had absolutely no interest. I had no interest at all. None. Zero. I hated it. I didn't want to go anywhere near science. It was boring to me. And I just walked out of class. I went back to my apartment and called my mother up and said, I'm dropping pre-med today. And she, to her great credit, and this is the difference between mothers and fathers, she said to me, whatever makes you happy makes me happy. And then I called up my father and I said, I'm dropping pre-med today. His response was, if you do, I'm not paying for school. I'm not paying for law school. You're not shifty enough to be a lawyer. This is a huge mistake. Go back into that class and finish it up. I said, I'm not going back into that class. I'm never going back again. I'm done with pre-med. If you don't want to pay for it, fuck you. And that was really pretty much my position on it. He tortured me about it for a while, said to me, well, I'll pay for law school, perhaps. And I remember I was applying to law school. And, you know, you remember these painful memories. I don't care if it was 40 years ago. You remember them your whole life. I had applied and I had gotten waitlisted at like every top 10 law school. You name it, I was waitlisted. That's just how it was back then. They didn't let you in. They wanted to measure the size of their class carefully, so they let a few in at a time. So I called my dad up, and I said, listen, I got into, and I mentioned a couple of schools that were like number 15 to 20. He says, I'm not paying for that. He says, you get in top 10, otherwise you pay for it yourself. I said, okay. A few weeks later, I got into Duke, and that was enough for him. And to his credit, you know, I appreciate everything you can get in life from people, even if it's a struggle. I graduated law school with no debt, no debt from college, no debt from law school. So I was very appreciative. And what my father had put me through by not believing in me was something that I used, I'm telling you, every single day of my career as a young lawyer. When I got out of law school, I took a job making $500 a week instead of a job making $86,000 a year, which is what the top law firms were paying back in the fall of 1990. But I wanted to become a lawyer, a trial lawyer, fast as I could. I wanted to learn it. And I knew in a big firm, even though it was so much money to me, I wouldn't learn anything. So I started in a very small firm where we got to see trials, or I got to watch. Then I went to another law firm, and we'll get to that in a minute, about where we did a lot of organized crime work. And I remember my father never saw me in court until I had cross-examined one of the killer cooperators in the John Gotti Jr. trial. So now I was 40 years old. It's now 20 years after he told me that I wasn't shifty enough. My dad, I flew up from Florida to watch me, and I was like a crazed animal during that cross-examination because my father was there. And he finally got to see the person that he didn't know existed, really. He thought of me as this young kid who just was quiet and not capable. And it was a horrifying cross. I mean, just physically brutal. I'm not a pleasant cross-examiner. I'm insulting. I'm abusive. I want to take your dignity from you. I don't want to just beat you. I want to humiliate and destroy you for the rest of your life. That's how I feel every cross-examination is. I don't care what the case is. I'm coming for your soul. I'm taking your heart if I can. And when I turned around at the break, we were going out to lunch, I looked up at my father, who I got a seat in the front row of the Gotti trial, and I looked at him, and his mouth was open in horror at what I had become. And I slapped him on the shoulder, and I said, shifty enough for you now? He said, what are you talking about? I said, you don't remember when I dropped pre-med and I was going to law school, and you told me that I wasn't shifty enough to be a lawyer? And he said, I never said that. I said, well, you did. I said, I might as well have it tattooed on the inside of my brain. I said, I appreciate it because it made me what I am now.
Wow. So this is John A. Gotti, known as Junior on the street, whose father was John J. Gotti, the boss of the Gambino crime family.
Correct.
So this time is what, around 1999 or 2000?
In 1999, I had actually written part of the father's appeal as a very young lawyer in the early 90s. And when I went to my second job, I was working for Jerry Chargell, who was, to me, you know, the greatest lawyer ever. He represented John Gotti Jr. And it was a different case. It was a racketeering case in White Plains. And during the representation, I became close with John. And he was offered a plea in that case. And he didn't want to take it. And Jerry and his other associate pushed him hard to take the plea. And all John cared about was if he took a plea that he would never get indicted again. So this was an issue back then. It was a big deal that he wanted coverage going forward, that they would never indict him again for any criminal activity that had occurred up to that point. And Jerry, who I loved like a father, who really made me, any, as I said when he passed away, that anything I have in life was because of Jerry. I didn't feel that there was coverage in the plea agreement. And it was difficult for me because John was somebody I cared about, but Jerry was my father. He became my father. And I told Jerry that I didn't think that the plea agreement was going to cover John. And I told John the same thing. And I knew that it wasn't a very loyal thing to do, but I wasn't going to lie to somebody who I considered a friend. And John took the plea. And before he went in, he came to see me in the office. And he said to me, and I'll never forget, this is another one of those memories. He said, if I ever get pinched again, I'm going with a young lawyer like you, not any of these old guys, because they don't care about me the way you do. And we shook hands. I gave him a hug. He went off to jail for, it was probably 4 or 5 years at this point. And I start reading in the newspapers that he's being investigated again now for the shooting of Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angel leader and also a radio host. And I get a call from his sister, who at the time was a reality TV star, if you remember, Victoria Gotti, and said John came to see me and said John wants you to visit him in Raybrook, where he was in jail. And this is now 2003, I suppose. I went to visit him. And first thing he said to me is, you remember the last thing I said to you before I went in? And I said, I'll never forget it. He says, well, you're my lawyer. Now, here's the rub, Deb. This was decades ago. I had never tried a case on my own at that point. Nobody knew that. And I had second-seated a lot of cases. And during the pendency of that representation of John before the trial, I had my first federal trial. And I remember I was working, the co-defendant's lawyer was Jimmy LaRosa, an Italian defense lawyer who to me was the greatest. He was just, you know, him and Jerry, he and Jerry were the best two ever in my mind. But Jimmy was older now. And we started doing the trial while I was representing John, as I said. And I didn't know if I was going to be good at this because you don't know until you actually do it. You can imagine you're good at it. You can hope you're good at it. You can train to be good at it. But until you get on your feet and you are in front of a jury and you are in the well of the courtroom, the federal courtroom, and it's terrifying for some people. And I had hoped that I had this in me, but I didn't know until I did it. And boy, it was like taking candy from a baby. It was the easiest thing. I was so terrified until I opened my mouth the first time in that courtroom. And it was completely natural for me. And during the trial, Jimmy pulled me aside and says, listen, you're a better lawyer than me now. You take the lead on this case going forward. You do the summation first. You do the cross-examinations. And I did. And by the time I got ready for John's trial, which was a year later about, I was ready for anything. And no one knew that it was my second trial. And it was a very easy trial for me. It was a lot of fun. I've never enjoyed myself so much as I did during that trial.
Well, just to establish a little bit of a foundation here for the listeners, the Gotti that you represented, his father, the boss of the Gambino crime family, was arrested in, I think it was 1992, and stayed in prison until his death from throat cancer in 2002. Did you ever have any interaction with the boss?
Well, as I said, I wrote part of his appeal. That's how I got involved with the Gottis. And then I left to go work for Jerry after that appeal was written. And Jerry was very involved in mafia cases. And look, when you grow up in New Jersey, in a largely Italian town, you become comfortable in this element. And I've learned that I'm comfortable in pretty much any element at this point. I grew up in a town where there were no blacks, and I represent rappers left and right now. If you can talk to people, you can talk to people. But I became very comfortable around Italians. A lot of my best friends still to this day are Italians. I mean, Italy's my favorite country in the world. I love Italians. I just seem to connect with them better. And Jerry had a ton of mafia clients, and they liked me. They took to me, and they respected me. I was a very young, hardworking kid. I was an unusual young lawyer. Christmas Eve, I was visiting somebody in prison. New Year's Eve, I was visiting somebody in prison. Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, I was on my way to prison. There was nothing that I wasn't willing to do anytime, anywhere. Somebody got arrested. I was, you know, going to Queens, a murderer sitting in a jail cell, locked in a jail cell with him. Somebody I had never met was accused of beating somebody to death. I had no fear, and I had no fear of working hard. And the clients saw it. These are not stupid people. They can smell fear. They can smell laziness. And they didn't smell any of that on me. And that's why I was capable when I worked for Jerry. I was with him for 7 years. And I was capable of going out on my own. And it was really seamless for me.
Now, Jerry Chargel, he's a Jewish guy?
Yes.
And so you also were very influenced by the more aggressive lawyer named James La Rosa.
Yes.
And he's an Italian.
He's Italian. He was Italian through and through.
So my question is, where do all these Jews end up representing these mafiosos who, you know, are so aligned with their heritage and generally, you know, want to work with other Italians?
It was a different era. That was still the golden age of mob lawyerdom, I would say. I think it really ended pretty much with Junior Gotti's trial. Back then, the best lawyers in New York City wanted to do those mob trials. And I'm talking back into the 60s and 70s. Jimmy represented Paul Castellano. Jerry represented Sammy Gravano. The best trial lawyers in the city in criminal law were the ones that were in small firms. The big firms didn't touch this kind of work. It was too dirty and too ugly. So it was always these small boutique firms, Gus Newman, you know, guys like that. Great, great trial lawyers. And the Italians wanted the best lawyers they could get. For the most part, many of them were Jews. I mean, look, this is just how it was. We were strong. We were smart. There were some good Italian defense lawyers. Jimmy obviously was at the very, very top. And Jimmy was the one who I tried my first trial with. Jimmy and Jerry were everything that I wanted to be. They were completely different trial lawyers. I took from Jimmy what I could. I took from Jerry what I could. And I tried to make it into something that resonated with me, because you can't be a phony if you're doing this. It has to be what you have in you. And not all of it fit me.
And do you think this growing up in New Jersey amongst, you know, the mob's kids or the future mafiosos, what was so compelling for you that you wanted to become in the first place a criminal defense attorney to the most criminal of all, you know, industries?
Well, I mean, in terms of law, the reason I wanted to be a criminal lawyer was because it was the only area of law where it was life and death. I don't want to be somebody whose life is defined by arguments over money or over property lines or over, you know, real estate. Ugh, gross. I have no interest. I want to be in a situation where I have your life in my hand and I'm either going to win or I'm going to lose. It's a binary result. Either win or I'm going to lose. So I needed the stress. I needed the pressure. I needed the drama of it. And why I ended up with those defendants, you know, I was a hardworking, studious kid. I wasn't a troublesome kid. And I suppose part of me wanted to live vicariously through those people. And becoming a defense lawyer and having the opportunity to represent them, I mean, you can't get any closer. That was it.
So when you were a kid, did you think those kids were the cool kids? Did you ever feel like you wanted to be part of the mob scene?
No, I think I wanted to be better than them. Okay. I viewed them as violent, as bullies. I liked a lot of them, but I knew exactly what they were. One thing I always was as a kid is I always had a very keen sense of myself and what other people were, even as a child. I'm really not much different now. I wanted to be better. I wanted to be stronger. I wanted to show them, yeah, I don't need a weapon. I don't need a fist. I can beat you with my brain. And I think that was probably part of it, is I wanted to be able to show them is that you're limited. You can only go so far with your brawn. This is where I take over and take you home.
So I got to wonder if these kids today are as focused as we were when we were young. You know, they don't get out enough. They're always on their computers and they've always got that phone in their hand, constantly looking at the phone. I'm guilty of it too. But it just seems everything is about the phones today.
Deb, I told my kids to watch. I said, we're going to watch the two Godfather movies. And one of them said, I already saw one of them. I said, when did you watch The Godfather? He said, I saw it on my phone. I said, you can't watch The Godfather on your phone, you idiot. I said, it's just the stupidest thing ever. You watch The Godfather on your phone. This is the mentality of kids today and why we're so much smarter than them.
Okay, let's get back to you. So when you say you became good friends with John A. Gotti, what is it that you felt you had in common?
I know people will find this hard to believe, but he is a prince among men. This is a guy that has always treated me from day one with the utmost respect and care and generosity. When my kids, my twins, were born 10 weeks prematurely, 2 weeks after John got indicted in the summer of 2004, my kids were 2 pounds and change, and they were in the incubators and they were in the hospital for months. And I have a trial to prepare for, the biggest trial of my life, and the entire world is watching me. I would go visit John in prison, and he would say to me, you don't have to be here. He says, go to your kids. Meanwhile, he's facing life in prison without parole if he loses.
And this is for racketeering.
Racketeering, but included violent acts, extortion, attempted murder, fraud, you name it.
This wasn't enough.
That attempted murder. That was one of the racketeering acts in the case.
And just for the people out there who don't know, Curtis Sliwa was the founder of a program called the Guardian Angels. It was a vigilante group of volunteers originally established to keep New York subways safe. How did he get involved with the mob, or how did the mob get involved with him?
Well, Curtis is a radio mainstay in New York City, and he was back then in the early 90s. And he was Italian, he was constantly saying horrible things about John Gotti Sr., about my client's father. And one day, he picked up a cab in the morning to go to the radio station for his show. And according to him, there were mafia guys that were driving the cab. They wouldn't let him out. And as he tried to dive out of the cab, when he realized that he thought he was going to be killed, they shot him. And he was shot in the stomach. That was his story. Eventually, people started cooperating, and they pinned the order of it on John Gotti Jr., who was doing it ostensibly for his father, for his father's honor. So I'm representing him, and I turn on Curtis's show, and he's talking about me. And he's saying, yeah, and this lawyer, whose new lawyer is some young guy, and he's 30-something years old, and he thinks he's going to be able to handle me on the stand. And I'm like, amused. I'm like, this is so cool. He's talking about me on the radio. And then he starts saying bad things about me. You know, he's just some kid from New Jersey, and I'm going to mop the floor with him. And I can tell you, and I have said this to so many people in life, I beg of you, don't underestimate me. I said, I assure you, this will be your final mistake with me. Do not underestimate me. And I started listening to him, and he is just shit-talking me every day. And I'm getting madder and matter. And he's hardly the biggest victim in the case. There were many other more important witnesses also, because all of John's purported co-conspirators were cooperators. Curtis was just a victim. But I made it my life's work to destroy him on the stand. And by the time he slunk off the stand, he was like, he oozed out of the seat. And I realized the reason I did that was not just because I was personally aggrieved and I wanted to humiliate him, but I realized that he was the face of the case for the government. The Curtis Lee was shooting was what the press was playing up when they talked about the case, because it was the most interesting crime that was charged. So if I could destroy the face of the case to the jury, I could destroy the government. And sure enough, when the jury came back, he wasn't convicted of a single charge.
So I read that it was a mistrial due to one juror. Is that correct?
On one of the counts, it was 11 to 1. What I've learned in trials since then and from then, I'm a very polarizing person. You either like me or you hate me. And when I spend a lot of time with you, it becomes even more pronounced, especially when I'm a lawyer. You either love me or you hate me. And I could see in the jury that I had like three people that hated my guts, but I had like nine that really liked me. And I had one woman, number one, who was in love with me. And so naturally, the three that hated me, you know, off to the side, go you. I ignored them during the summation and I focused on the ones that liked me. And when the trial was over, I got a phone call from somebody who was friendly with number one. And she said, just wanted you to know that she saved your client. I'm like, I figured it was her.
Wow. Yeah. Well, all I know is we love you and you're the right person to have on one side if ever needed, that's for sure. And I do want to get back to just the state of our country right now. And I want to ask you, what concerns you most about the future of America?
I think the fact that we've got so many people here that hate America. I'm terrified about how kids have been brainwashed. When you see that kids are openly supporting Hamas in New York schools, a mile from ground zero, I mean, it's like, it would be like rooting for Al Qaeda after 9/11. It's horrifying to me because I look at what's going on in Europe and I feel that we're not very far behind. I feel that there's a moral rot in this country. And believe me, I don't blame it on just one side. The far left and the far right share it equally. And the people that are reasonable in the center we're more in numbers, but we're quieter in voice. So that is a horrifying thing. I don't think people care about this country enough. And as somebody who grew up with not much, when I graduated law school, I had $1,000 to my name. I had nothing. I paid for both of my parents' funerals. I love this country, and it is the land of opportunity. And you can become anything you want in this country if you're willing to work. There are too many people here that use excuses, that don't want to work hard, that consider themselves victims. And sometimes you just have to shake it off and overcome it if you want to succeed. I don't see that in America today. And I see too much loathing, and it really makes me sick.
Where do you stand on, you know, like the border between us and Mexico? I know that you represented one of the, if not the biggest drug lord, Mexican drug lords, El Chapo. How do you feel about drugs infiltrating the borders, all this fentanyl crisis?
I not only represent El Chapo, but I represent his wife, Emma Coronel, and I represent his four sons, one of whom is in a jail cell in Chicago, and the other three that are in Mexico that are fugitives. How do I feel about it? Obviously, I'm aghast at the drugs that move from Mexico into America, but the main reason they move from Mexico into America is because Americans can't stop doing drugs. We do more drugs than any country in the world. We probably do more drugs than the next 10 countries put together. And that's the reason why the drugs are coming here, is because there's so much demand. So in terms of the border, they're not just Mexicans that are coming over. There are people that are coming from all over. They're just entering from Mexico. You've got jihadists that are coming from the Middle East that are coming through the Mexican border. You've got all of South and Central America. They're coming through the Mexican border. So it's certainly not just Mexicans. I think that we let in, what we did was an utter disaster. We've let in, I don't know, 10 million illegals in the last 4 years. I'm not some kind of xenophobe. My grandparents came over here from Europe. So obviously I'm all for immigration. But we're bringing people over that are not being vetted. We're bringing people over that are not waving an American flag. They don't have an American flag on their houses as my grandparents did when they came over. They don't love America. They want to turn America into where they came from. And it's okay to take some, but when you can't take care of your own at all. I mean, I'm in New York City and we're cutting every basic service because we've got too many migrants that we're, you know, making sure they can go to school and they've got everything they need. It's too many. I'm all for legal immigration. I'm all for people coming here for asylum. But to just open the borders and look the other way very well could be the end of America. And anybody who sees it otherwise is either dishonest or insane. We just can't take care of our own, and we shouldn't be taking care of people who we don't even know what they are.
Well, I find it interesting that, you know, when you look at these school shootings or these mass shootings or the shootings at the synagogue or the shooting in, you know, upstate New York, these shootings were not perpetrated by illegal Mexicans. They were mostly perpetrated by white Americans right here that are deranged. So how do we contend with that?
That's a whole other issue. And I'm a gun guy. This is not just my interview room. This is my gun room. But the gun problem, I'm for gun control. I think any real gun person who's intelligent and is not a lunatic recognizes that we have a gun problem in America. There should be a database of anybody who is receiving psychotropic drugs, any kind of mental help, any kind of therapy. That should be a bar. You go to buy a gun, you press a button on the computer, it immediately accesses a database, and no, you cannot have that gun. And that's the first problem. But of course, you've got too many crazy right-wing gun guys that say, no, no, no. If you start to have a database where people can't get guns because of mental health issues, it's a slippery slope and they're going to grab our guns. Well, that's idiotic. So that's the first thing we can do to start. I don't have any problem with the fact that you should have to show some kind of proficiency with a gun before you get it. You should have to take a test every few years to show that you're up to, you know, in terms of the rules and in terms of being able to shoot it. There's many things that can be done.
Well, I am a believer that everyone has the right to bear arms in order to protect themselves or their property. And I also, I kind of like guns for sport, but I don't know what the purpose of, you know, semi-automatic weapons really is.
Well, a semi-automatic gun is any handgun. There are better ways. Certain guns shouldn't be sold to the public. There's just no need for them. I mean, if you really care about protecting yourself and protecting your property, you can get by without some of the really high-end weapons. But at the same time, Deb, if somebody wants to kill somebody in a school, they're going to do it. It might help to have maybe a retired law enforcement person or a veteran at the school with a gun. There are many things that can be done. If you want to kill somebody, you're going to kill them. And the bad guys are the ones getting the guns. Making rules for the good people with guns isn't the answer, unfortunately.
Well, speaking of death and destruction and murdering, you really have never felt any fear or that your life is in jeopardy working with these sorts of people, representing them?
I don't think I've ever really felt any fear. Have I felt that my life has been in danger? Many times, hundreds of times. I get threatened a lot. I get stalked. But I suppose the reason that I'm capable of doing this kind of work is the same reason why I don't get scared when maybe I should be. I just feel that none of us are going to be here forever. I'm not living forever. And I'm not going to live my life. You know, there's a saying, I'd rather die on my feet, you know, than live on my knees. And that's just how I feel. I mean, the fear for the clients representing El Chapo, I said some things during that trial about the Mexican government that, you know, were international news, and I got a lot of threats from it. You know, obviously, I don't want anybody around me to be harmed, but for me, I'm not afraid.
Well, I want to give you back your time because I know that you are a very busy person, and I honor your time that you gave us today. And I appreciate you, and so happy that we got to have you here.
Absolutely. Thanks, Deb.
This episode of Debracratic was hosted by me, Deborah Drucker. It was produced by Lee Rocker with co-production and editing by Gideon Brower. Our amazing music was performed by Amy Nelson and Kathy Guthrie of Folk Uke. Be sure to rate and review this episode wherever you listen to podcasts. For more Debracratic, check out DebraCraddock.com and our Instagram at DebraCraddock. That's D-E-B-O-R-A-H Craddock, like Democratic. Until next time. Political is personal, so